Hey, hockey families, this one is for you. This is a situation report for April. I've been writing these up typically, and now I'm thinking maybe I should have actually been doing them verbally, because maybe you'd rather be sorting socks, folding socks, sweeping your floor, picking up pine cones, cleaning pollen off your car, anything but reading. So maybe this would have been a lot more useful format for you. So it starts out with a unfortunate news that I just heard this morning regarding the Ontario Hockey League, and those guys are unable to finish their season. And I just wanted to raise my hat to all of you in Virginia Beach, because anyone from Ontario could give you a call and ask you what protocols work, and you know now how to play through a tremendous surge. To be honest with you, in the sit rep, I give you a sense of, you know, where they are incidence-wise compared to here, compared to Michigan. And I tell you what, Virginia Beach hockey families, we've been through worse. And I don't say that with pride. I say that with tremendous gravity and appreciation for what you did this last year. And thanks to your fearless leader, Rich, and all of the coaches, all the team managers, and all the parents who made it possible. So this sit rep is for you. And then after that, I just really give us a roundup on incidents here in Virginia Beach, Michigan, and give you a little bit of a projection about where I think we're going. And then vaccine availability, how to get your hands on it. If you can't listen to the whole thing, literally just do one thing. Go to vaccinefinder.org. You can get the vaccine currently at the convention center at FEMA on Military Way. Those two are walk-ins. You can go to your local pharmacy. And the useful thing about your local pharmacy is you can actually tell if it's Pfizer or Moderna. And that's only useful if you have a child who's 16 or 17, because those two age groups, 16, 17-year-olds, can only get Pfizer right now. 18 and over can get either of the two, Pfizer or Moderna, or Janssen, when and if they come back online. And then, you know, the whole decision about vaccination for players, for athletes, I think is an interesting one to consider, because generally speaking, they're low risk, but the logistics of dealing with lost time and quarantine and, you know, the inability to play and the impact on the whole family and other players, you guys lived through this last year. You kind of know what that means. So now that anybody age 16 and up can actually get vaccinated, and soon I would expect age 12 and up, this episode might be worth listening to in full, because you're going to have some options in front of you. And I've put a lot of thought into this, because vaccinating somebody who's very low risk for severe consequences to natural infection with a new vaccine is something that we should take seriously and should really think about before doing. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that over the last month. Myself and Sam actually did go get vaccinated on Monday. This is 2 days after. We're feeling good. And, I think I'm better prepared to report on that for you. Yesterday, I released an episode that dealt with some anxiety. So I'm just going to be honest. You know, it was not a decision I made lightly. But I am thankful that we did go, and I'm thankful that we have the option. And I just think it's worth thinking through for our players. So please take a listen if you have time and would like to know, you know, kind of a 360 on the vaccination decision for young, low-risk people. And then I close with something that's kind of a policy consideration that might be of interest only to nerdy MPH Eppies out there. But given that all of you hockey people are super smart, you might be curious to peer into my world for a little bit and construct a 2x2 table regarding actual disease versus test outcomes, and why it doesn't really make sense to test asymptomatic people, and why Rich and I really tried to ask only symptomatic people to go get tested, and then watch and wait for the rest of the folks, because asymptomatic people getting tested, it's kind of a wild card. So anyway, take a listen if you have time. I hope that you find this useful, and share it with your buddies if you'd like. And please let me know if there's another format you'd like, shorter, longer, whatever. I'm doing my best to pack the first few minutes with what you need to know, and then you can delve into the details in the actual episode. Thank you again, and thank you for being my new friends here and for being so supportive last year. I'm so thankful to have had this opportunity to learn about how to play hockey through a pandemic, and I just hope that we can help some other areas. Thanks, guys. Hey, anybody who's listening, it's Allie. I'm back. I know, I must be in a mania. It's another episode, and it's only been a day. So a couple things are prompting this mania. One is it's 48 hours almost post-vaccination on Monday. I feel good. My son feels good. We're both fine. We actually went to hockey last night. I ran today, lifted weights today, went to physical therapy, did work. I'm feeling good. I am even going to allow myself to consider the remote notion that whatever lingering weird symptoms I had from COVID back in October, I actually got COVID on Halloween, believe it or not. Kids called me the fun killer. I'm going to allow myself to believe the rumor on the ground, which is vaccination helps with long COVID symptoms. And so I'm just going to go bionic. I already think my hearing's bionic. I'm hearing things, I'm seeing things, having interesting dreams, which happened to me during COVID as well. So feeling good. Secondly, I got an email this morning from hockey director, my buddy who keeps me posted on the world outside of COVID in Virginia Beach. And I was really shocked and kind of sad, but not surprised, disappointed, chagrined to find out that the Ontario Hockey League, one of the main feeders of the NHL, has decided not to proceed with their season. I guess they were going to try to work within all the mitigations up there in Ontario, but they just decided they needed to call the ball and or the puck and decided to stop. So that just got me in a bit of a tear this morning, which apparently hasn't quit, because it's really unfortunate. But before I jumped to conclusions, I decided to take a look at the epidemiologic data, and I dug around and looked for Ontario data and looked at the different localities, cities within Ontario. I looked at the cases, the rolling 7-day incidents per 100,000 population, which is what I prefer to look at, because it's what I know here in Virginia, and I can relate that to other places, and it's also what the CDC looks at with regard to decisions about schools, etc. So rolling 7-day, it used to be 14, but everyone seemed to go back to 7. So I was looking around at weekly incidents per 100,000, and honestly, my impression is it's no worse there than we went through here in Virginia Beach, and this thing can be managed. And so I was like furious for a little bit, probably 10 minutes, just, you know, chagrined for those young kids, those athletes who are NHL and Olympic team feeders, and here they are not able to finish their season, not able to do their tournaments. You know, I know people listening might think, gosh, you know, what a myopic view. It's just hockey. It's just a game. But if you know anything about these kids and you know anything about any athlete who's at peak condition between, you know, 17 and whatever they are, 23, I'm going to guess, then you can appreciate how that might have an impact on their, you know, just on their near-term outlook. I think we all, any of us who are parents or teachers or counselors, before COVID, we knew well enough that young adults tend to be fairly short-term horizon planners. They don't really weigh long-term consequences. You know, they make decisions based on what's proximal, what's right in front of them. So this is going to be really hard for me to, you know, to sit quietly by and see happen all over the place when it doesn't need to. This thing can be managed. Good communication, good cooperation, good protocols, amazing people like in our hockey family here in Virginia Beach, and you know, these kids could play. So it's super unfortunate. Obviously, cases are all around them in the community, but you know, with a bit of, you know, serious structure and serious commitment, they could stay on the ice. So that's my opening rant. It's frustrating. To know a little bit, to have some real world experience, to think that we've found, you know, a way through, a way to thread the needle and play through a season and not be able to help anybody else. Because we're, you know, just one little community here. But if this podcast gets shared and if anybody's listening and if anybody wants our protocols, we are wide open. We want to help you. Okay, deep breath. Every month around this time, I don't really plan it, but around this time I find myself mid-month going, gosh, it's time for a situation report. Where are we? Pick your nose up from the work that you're doing. and look around, look at the country, you know, see how Virginia Beach compares to the nation, see how we're trending, see what's happening with regard to incidents, what's happening with vaccines now. It's worth talking about that because this week, anybody age 16 and up can actually get vaccinated. So here's kind of an overview. Virginia Beach, as I alluded to, was in a high transmission state all the way through the surge through the winter. And we very briefly in March last month, the last time I came up for air and looked around, we were a yellow state for like a week at 107 cases per 100,000 population. Remember that 7 day. This is so anytime I give you 107 per 100K, it's 7 day incidence. In January, we were statewide at 388. In Virginia Beach, we were at 615. So, wow, the sunset's unbelievable. Okay, sorry. Thunderstorm went through. Sunset's amazing. Major distraction. So we're kind of in a holding pattern right now. Precisely this minute, we are at 111 cases per 100K and 5.9% positivity. Last month, it was 5.5% positivity. So that means every time, they collect all of the tests and they look to see what percent are positive, you know, 95% of the time it's not COVID. So it's just worth remembering. When we were at a 20% positivity in the winter and, you know, anybody who is symptomatic, we told to go get tested. Let me rephrase that. We strongly encouraged to go get tested and these amazing parents did go get tested. 95% of those people came back positive because we encourage testing among those who are symptomatic. And that's important to remember when I get into my third and final rant, when we talk about asymptomatic testing in a low prevalence time. So just right now it's 5.9% positivity. 94% of the time it's not going to be COVID. It's something else causing symptoms, or these people were asymptomatic and had to get tested for some other reason. We are trending down, but really we're just in a holding pattern. We're kind of flirting with COVID being under control, I think, if more people get vaccinated. Now comparing our situation to the rest of the country, we are actually still, believe it or not, according to Health and Human Services, which does a community profile report. So it takes a look at the entire nation, uses the same metrics, tries to get the apples to apples comparisons, pulling all the data that they can as quickly as they can from the localities. We are actually still in the red. We are still in a high transmission status. And that's because over 7 day cases of 100 per 100K is kind of the threshold that they use. So yeah, we're flirting with dipping below that, but we're not quite there. Michigan is somewhere around 300 to 500 and we're at 100. So we've been there, we've done that, Michigan. We can help you if you want to reach out. Now, one thing that's making life more challenging in Michigan than it was here, and our turn will come, I'm sure of it, is they have the B.1.17 variant floating around. The last I checked last week, it was pretty prevalent. It was like the leading variant. It was around 67 to 70% of all of the, strains sampled. That was approximately 70% of all of them that were identified, typed. National average B.1.17 is about 30%. Now this variant is 50% more transmissible, so that could be making life pretty challenging there. Moving into vaccinations, on the whole, the U.S. is prioritizing two doses or full vaccination, whereas the U.K. is prioritizing get one dose at least in arms. It's kind of two different strategies. It's interesting to watch how this plays out. We do have enough vaccine to fully vaccinate everybody, but I think that paying attention to just getting one dose at least in arms for those who are a little bit hesitant, might be willing to do one but are worried about what they've heard from their friends about that second dose being a bit of a doozy, I think it would be worth encouraging people to just think about at least getting one because it looks like real-world effectiveness is maybe 80% protection. So vaccine availability. Right now, anyone, as I mentioned, in the U.S., ages 16 and up, can get vaccinated. So if you're 16 or 17, the vaccine that's licensed for you, actually licensed is too strong of a word. It's emergency use authorization, and that's EUA. Excuse me. So if you're 16 and up, that's Pfizer. 18 and up, you can get either Pfizer or Moderna. Right now, you can go in by walk-in through the convention center, and you can also go to the FEMA clinic on Military Way. There are local pharmacies offering it. I found Harris Teeter is actually doing it, Walmart as well, CVS, Walgreens, and you can go to vaccinefinder.org and look around for your closest opportunity to get vaccinated. I would say, while this is all just kind of, you know, opening wide as far as availability, I might call ahead or at least pick a place that you go to often on the off chance that like something happened and your appointment didn't go through or they ran out of stock or something weird happened. When I went to Walgreens on Monday, I was like shot number 10 that they had done at all. So just cut people some slack, be aware that things are just kind of going wide open, trying to move vaccines out from these huge clinics into local areas where people traditionally go for other things. I think that's great. I think we need to bring vaccines out into the community in a very dispersed fashion and catch people where they are. For adults, vaccination coverage in Virginia is about average compared to the nation. The national average is between 30 to 46% of adults have had at least one dose here in the US, and 24% are fully vaccinated. Virginia is at about 37% of adults with at least one dose, last I checked this week. So we're doing pretty well. Last I checked, Maine was the leader at 46%. I wanted to talk for our hockey community anyway, in case anyone's listening. The decision about vaccinating players, so these were going to be kids. These are young adults and kids, right? So I already mentioned age 16 and up, so that's our high schoolers. You have an option to consider. And what do I really think about vaccinating those kids? I touched on this in my episode yesterday where I was really kind of grappling with how to deal with anxiety because I think that's a real thing. It's an option to get vaccinated. But today I want to reframe it a little bit and say for those kids, because we have data on them and we do have a vaccine for them, you actually have an opportunity to choose how you're going to get immunity for your child. And that choice is between vaccination or disease. So again, I'm not a clinician. I'm just an epidemiologist and a mother who thinks a lot about things. And I really care about being honest and transparent. I think that with a high prevalence of COVID still in our area, we're still a high transmission area. We have this B.1.17 more transmissible variant on the loose. We have the likelihood, in my opinion, looking at the Spanish flu in 1918. And just looking at pandemic curves in general, I think we've got at least another surge. My guess is going to be it's not going to be as high as last winter, but it's going to be decent. I am going to guess we're going to have another summer surge. It's going to be very moderate, and I think we're going to have a higher winter surge because respiratory viruses, let's face it, they circulate when the air is cool and people are inside. So we've got another winter of annoyance. So the reality is, if you're a family that values youth sports, values living your life, values being active in the community, values being able to move about in the world and really try to maximize normality as much as you can, you are more than likely going to run into COVID. So I think for your child, and this is assuming your child has no chronic conditions, no particular health risks, even. Okay, so I'm taking the best case scenario. My personal opinion, having looked at everything and thought it over the last few days, and of course this is colored by being thankful that I got vaccinated and my son and I are both doing fine, I think the benefits of vaccination outweigh the risks. And I think that because if you are thinking about preventing infection and avoiding lost time due to quarantine and isolation, if your child is exposed or someone in your family is exposed or contracts COVID. And then you also consider the potential for some longer term return to play issues, specifically long COVID, which is being reported sporadically by athletes. I mentioned that yesterday. I think it's being overreported, but it is out there. Fatigue, lost endurance, heart palpitations. All of that is a consideration. So vaccination would help you kind of sidestep those things. So if you think about the benefits, I think that it gives you a sense of, hey, these vaccines are very safe. And what are the realities of actually dealing with another year of COVID in circulation, but no vaccine on board? I think you have maybe some food for thought there. So how would you like to acquire immunity? So I mentioned you can do it either via infection or vaccine. So are there any risks associated with infection? And I talked about those briefly, maybe long COVID. We also talked about even if your child doesn't have COVID, him or herself, being exposed to someone in the family means they've got a quarantine. And if you did that last year, you know that's a pain. You're looking at 10 days away from the rink. It appears that, to me, the vaccination is a good choice because the protection is very high against symptoms, and that's at least 80% out in the real world. In clinical trials, it was 94-95%, but in the real world, it looks like it's around 80% against symptoms at all and against transmission, and then very high against severe disease or hospitalization and death, and that's well over 95%. What are the risks of vaccination? So that's possible systemic reaction for about 24 hours and very rare events like clots. And I'll get to that in just a second. What are the risks of COVID infection for kids? So we just talked about, some of the logistical hassles. We talked about the benefits of vaccination as far as protection. What are the risks of your child actually getting COVID? We tend to think of kids being fairly bulletproof, right? But according to the AAP, which did a national review of data, and I have a link that I can send to you if you want to shoot me a note and ask for it. I have this all, everything that I'm saying to you is written up in a report that you can read with links. So the AAP reports that children continue to have very mild cases and they rarely require hospitalization. So 0.1% to 1.9% of all pediatric cases that they looked at across the nation over, since last January, meaning like a year ago January, between 0.1% and 2% of all pediatric cases resulted in a hospitalization. But they also note, and so that was 3.6 million pediatric cases. Some of the children who end up with this multisystem inflammatory syndrome, the MISC, they were actually asymptomatic. And the CDC is not currently clear on what risk factors might predict your child getting MISC. So it is really rare, but the thing that always bugs me, and it bugged me about chickenpox, is you can't really risk stratify which of the kids are going to have a really serious problem. And before the chickenpox vaccine, 100 kids per year in the nation died due to chickenpox, and we really could not risk stratify which kids that was going to happen to. That has bothered me for 15 years. So when I find another infection that it behaves that way, with that kind of irregularity, it makes me think pretty carefully about, gosh, there's a way to avoid it. Do I want to do that? Am I willing to take that risk? Because I don't really have any prior knowledge that would help me. So I also looked at hospitalization data myself using COVIDNet, and I looked at kids who were hospitalized, and 47% of all of the kids who were hospitalized had no identifiable underlying chronic condition. So I'm like, what in the world? It's bad data, partially, probably. So maybe in the chart notes, the attending in the hospital knew, but it didn't make it into the data set, right? 35% had obesity, and upper 20s, 20% had asthma. So asthma is decently prevalent. That's a known risk factor. I think I would certainly pay attention to the opportunity to get vaccinated for anybody who has an age-appropriate child who does have moderate or severe asthma. All right, so I think my bias is vaccination sounds like a good idea for the kids who can access it. Certainly a good idea for kids who have underlying conditions that would make them very sick. If you're still on the fence, though, and you want to think about it longer, one thing you could do is consider getting vaccinated yourself. And that way you're going to reduce the likelihood of bringing COVID into your home. The household transmission studies suggest that kids are more likely to get COVID from their parents than vice versa. So you could maybe buffer them a little bit by getting parents and caregivers vaccinated. just some food for thought. Now, some interesting developments to be thinking about for those of you with younger kids. Pfizer has submitted an EUA for ages 12 to 15 based on data from a clinical trial. And in that trial were 2,200 children ages 12 to 15. The mRNA vaccine was well tolerated and 100% effective. Now, they have not, at least as far as I can tell, released the briefing document submitted to the FDA, so I can't look at the nitty-gritty of the data. But I will as soon as I can get my hands on it. They are reviewing that right now, and I would anticipate soon you will hear from FDA and ACIP regarding their recommendation. I would anticipate with data like that they're going to give it the EUA. So soon, children ages 11 and up will have an opportunity to be vaccinated. The interesting thing that occurred to me while I was thinking this all through is in the original adult study for Pfizer, there were 43,000 adults enrolled and then randomized half and half to the placebo and the vaccine arm. But when you get right down to the 16 and 17-year-olds in that trial, there were only 53 kids in the initial trial who were ages 16 and 17. So when you think about 2,200 kids in that 12 to 15 age group, I think I might have said 11 and up. I'm sorry, I meant 12 to 15. We actually know a lot more about the next EUA that we get for kids than we do about the older kids, okay? So I think that's good. Now, encouragingly, for adults and for those 16 and 17-year-olds, looking at real-world data on people who have gotten vaccination, and I think you probably heard the announcement that we are nearing 200 million doses. I think tomorrow Biden's going to announce that. We have a lot of data collected, and one of the exciting things CDC did last summer in advance of the vaccines being authorized, not licensed yet, is create something called V-Safe, and that's something you can enroll in with your cell phone. So you just literally, while you're waiting to get your shot, plug in your cell phone number, and every day for 7 days in the afternoon, somewhere between 4 and 5, you're going to get pinged, and CDC will ask you, are you feeling any symptoms? Injection site reactions, systemic reactions, headache, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, rashes. It asks everything, and then you can actually put in other stuff if it's not listed. Every day for 7 days, and they follow you for a year. So JAMA reviewed all of this. They reviewed millions of reports so far and have some data for us. So of the millions of reports, so over 3 million reported at least one dose, and 1.9 million actually have filed reports after dose two. It's looking like both vaccines have more systemic reactogenicity after dose two than after dose one. You've probably heard that. Dose two is the doozy, right? The top three reported systemic reactions were fatigue, headache, and muscle aches. The thing I should point out, though, is only half of all of these people reporting actually said they had any of those. And if you think about the people who are very likely to join in a active surveillance system and respond to these push reminders, they're going to be the people who are pretty tuned into their health, pretty health conscious, and they want to report these things. So I think that these people would tend to over-report versus under-report. So I think the odds are good. We're probably hearing a lot of data from them. No, it's not all 200 million people, but again, it covers 3.6 million people who are reporting in at least once during the 7 days after dose one, and 1.9 million people after dose two. I mentioned yesterday that there was some preliminary data in the clinical trial briefing document that suggested that Pfizer had pretty similar reactions, dose one and dose two, and Moderna was the one that seemed to have a stronger dose two reactogenicity profile. That held true in this JAMA article as well. So yesterday I was talking you through how to work through your anxiety, how to convince yourself to get off the fence and make a decision. And if you're worried about being laid out for, you know, a day after vaccination, it's not likely going to happen after dose one. And if you were really freaking out, just schedule yourself for Pfizer, because then you can kind of like, you know, minimize the likelihood that you're going to have a more reactogenic response. Again, just ping me if you want all of this written up in a link to that JAMA article. Or you can go JAMA, V-Safe, reactogenicity and published in April, and you'll find it. I think it might have been April 9th. Few final thoughts. Can breakthrough happen after vaccination, breakthrough infection? Yes, it's super rare. 6,000 reports, and we've got nearly 200 million vaccinations done. The symptoms are usually mild. To date, 74 deaths have been reported. And through my little network of state epidemiologists, who I know personally, I know that they are frantically working on studying this and understanding it. Can clots happen after vaccination? Yes, they can. I looked into this a few weeks ago when we first started hearing about, you know, that platelet crash following one of the mRNA vaccines. It's come up again, obviously, with the Janssen pause. And I'm really interested in this. I'm curious about it. I'm a woman. It seems to happen to women in my age group. Yes, it does happen, but it's extremely rare. It does happen after infection. It's like 39 in a million after COVID, natural disease. And it's right now, they're thinking maybe 1 in a million, maybe a little more if we restrict that denominator to just the women in that age group, but it's pretty rare and more likely after natural infection. And it does also happen after other vaccines. So it's not like these mRNA vaccines are, you know, terribly different insofar as they can potentially, I'm not even sure this has been confirmed yet, can potentially be linked to a clot. So there are sometimes these rare side effects. And the challenge with vaccines is, again, as I mentioned yesterday, comparing risk to risk. I think your risk of having something that would be very annoying, drag you down, make you regret not getting vaccination is greater as if you get infected. I really think you'll be more likely to be happy you actually went and got vaccinated. So it's, again, just weighing those two. I also saw today that the AAP earlier this month has recommended that any child who has had COVID visit their pediatrician or family doctor to get clearance before resuming any sports. And yes, I read this 12 times to be sure I saw it correctly. Any sports, including PE, regardless of severity. I thought I had seen something about it a month ago suggesting that no cardiac clearance was needed if the child was asymptomatic. But I read carefully the AAP recommendations, and some school districts will go with this. Before your child participates in youth sports or PE, they're recommending doctor clearance. So I think it's overly cautious, but it's, you know, maybe kind of like baseline concussion testing. At least you'll have a baseline, and that is what the AAP recommends. Okay, those are my thoughts on where we are, current situation here in Virginia Beach, thoughts on vaccine availability, whether or not it makes sense to go ahead and vaccinate very low risk active people who want to stay active. I think on the whole, I say yes. Should adults get vaccinated? I say that's a bigger yes. I think the benefits are pretty clear there. And if you have questions, please shoot them my way. Again, this is all written up. I promised to get into asymptomatic testing and a mini rant on that. I will try to do it in 2 minutes so we can wrap this up, but it is complicated. The CDC is not recommending asymptomatic testing in schools when positivity is less than 5% or there's fewer than 20 cases per 100,000. And the reason they're not recommending that is because of the risk of false positives. And I went through a whole 2x2 table where you, if you want to construct a 2x2 table and try to noodle this out, put on the top actual disease, and then on the left, positive and negative, and then on the left side of your table, your 2x2 table, put the test, and then positive, negative. So you should have like a four square, and test at the top, and then truth on the left. So that top left box will be positive, positive. And the bottom right box will be negative, negative. And then you can construct sensitivity and specificity of the test, which you can actually find in the EUAs for these rapid tests. Then you think about prevalence in your area, because that informs, using Bayes' theorem, that actually informs how you interpret these results. And the interpretation is the predictive value positive. And so as prevalence goes up, your predictive value positive goes up. And so when you get over 5% prevalence in your area, when you get a positive test result, you can have a little bit more confidence that it's a real positive. When it's below 5%, you are going to quarantine and disrupt and annoy more people who are actually negative than people who are truly positive and you've missed. It's kind of phenomenal, okay? And that's for a typical test with sensitivity of 97%. And that means you catch 97% of those who are actually sick, and specificity of 99%. And that means you say 99% of the people who are actually negative, you say are negative. So that's that bottom right box, the negative, negative. That top left box, the positive, positive, is the 97%. I know I went through fast, that fast. This is worth a whole episode if anybody wants to suffer through that. Can't imagine you do, but it's actually really interesting with regard to policy formation and how we interpret tests. And, you know, for anybody in our hockey family who's listening and who wonders what Rich and I work on, it is working on being really careful with what we ask people to do. And we want to make sure that there's maximum value in the hassle factor of going out and finding a test. And I will tell you, some of our families actually paid out of pocket, you know, more than $200, our family being one, to go get tests. And they even had to deal with TRICARE bouncing, like rejecting a COVID test in the middle of the winter surge because there was a modifier missing at the urgent care clinic where the test was done, a special modifier for the COVID test. So the CARES Act means all tests should be free, right? You shouldn't have any barriers to testing. But in reality, I know that some of our families had to deal with that. And that is just, that makes me gnash my teeth too. Almost like the Ontario Hockey League, those OHL players who are missing out on their tournament. So again, thank you very much for listening, for thinking this through, for trusting, you know, your hockey COVID response team to do their very best, to devise protocols that are good, that are resilient, and that, you know, didn't really need to be modified, that were effective at keeping COVID out of the rink and kept our players on the ice. And just know that we're going to continue watching this and do the best that we can as we go forward and as the situation evolves and as more people get vaccinated. So we're not quite at a place yet where we can just go back to normal. As I said, I anticipate some more surges, but I think they're going to be, I'm just going to hazard a guess that the peaks that we're going to see are going to be half what they were. But still, even if there's half as many cases, if you're one of the cases, you know, it's a disruption to your life. I understand that. So again, even one is a challenge to work through, and I want to help you prevent it as best I can. All right. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great night.